I will take you with me. You might learn something.
About soccer?
Nah, mate. Not about soccer. And for fuck's sake, stop saying soccer!
Fulfilling regulations that come from Switzerland and then through Stockholm, which are guidelines that are made for big stadiums in big cities made out of concrete, which have totally killed the life of our beautiful sport, we will refuse to abide for that. And there, I think we can win. You had always two things to actually keep the workers from drinking in the evening. They either played instruments in the brass band or football. So a mill town is structured around work and around the union and around the sort of organizations created for the workers to have a organized leisure time. So we have great musicians from Degerfors and great football players.
This is the voice of Frederik Rakar, the president of Degerfors EF, which currently sits 13th out of 16 teams in the Swedish men's top tier. You probably already got the sense from these comments, but he heads up what is really one of the most unusual and lovely and countercultural stories that professional football in Europe has to tell at the moment. And he is a very unusual chairperson for a professional soccer club. Frederik is a sociologist who moved to Degerfors because he wanted to, essentially, make less money and didn't really have any football background until he ended up on the board of Degerfors EF. And how he and his club chart the course of a largely volunteer-run club with deep roots in a small steel town in which football means so much to the people there, amidst the pressures of global soccer capitalism, is a fascinating story. I don't say this lightly, but I think the following hour and 20 minutes will be enough for you to find your sentimental favorite among European professional teams. The town of Degerfors itself is kind of off the beaten path in Sweden, in the country's rust belt. I went there on a 3.5 hour journey from Stockholm with like 3 buses and 1 train this May. I ate at the fans pub, which is a pizzeria that's run by immigrants from Bosnia, met with volunteers who run Sweden's only football museum in Degerfors, saw a draw between Degerfors EF and Hammarby from Stockholm, which you may know from the earlier episode on the 3 big clubs in Stockholm. And then I talked to Frederik a little later. What you're about to hear is an attempt to honor the warm welcome and deep dedication to the beautiful game among the people in Degerfors. I've interspersed the interview with Frederik with some brief impressions from the tour that Mats Fransson, a retired volunteer, gave me through the football museum in Degerfors before the game. Sven-Göran Eriksson, famous Swedish coach-manager who once managed the English national team as well about a decade ago, once said that in some places, football is nothing, and in some places, it's heaven or hell. And then there's Degerfors. I think you will love this story as much as I did. Have fun.
We are in not just the oldest, but the only football museum in Sweden.
That's right.
Degerfors has how many inhabitants?
About 7,000.
It's nowhere close to any big city?
No.
But it has Sweden's only football museum?
Yeah.
Why?
Because you have 7,000 fans of football in Degerfors. Because everybody likes football. And it's an old tradition to be in the first league in Sweden and so on. So it's a big tradition. Even my mother, she's 86, she looks at the games.
By far the smallest town in the Swedish upper league, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
By far.
By far. There are a lot of things in here, including very old things. How did you get? I see a football shoe over there, for example.
Yeah.
From which year is that? About how old is this?
I don't know.
1963?
Yeah, but we have from the 20s.
You have some from the 20s?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well. And I don't know. This sign only says that in 63, 9 of 11 in the starting team was working at the ironworks in Degerfors.
Yeah.
So historically, that's why we could have good players to come to Degerfors, because you could get them work at the same time.
Fredrik, you are the real-life president of a professional First League football club in Sweden, but your journey there has been highly unusual. And in fact, the whole club, Degerfors IF, is a highly unusual club. Before we get there to this little industrial town in the middle of Sweden and try to find out how it's surviving in modern football and why, what is your journey into this whole thing? And what's your actual full-time job, professional background? Because being a president of a football club is not a full-time job in Sweden, at least not in Degerfors.
Yeah, it's actually a fully voluntary job. That means I'm not remunerated in any way, except for the occasional free beer at Bosna, the local pub. Yes, I moved to Degerfors 9 years ago on a hunch. I just wanted to sort of improve my life in terms of quality and take me out of the vicious circle of working more and more and having more and more expenses. So when my daughter left for America, she currently lives in Los Angeles, or since 9 years back, then I started to look around in Sweden and in the world to see where I wanted to spend my next 10, 20 years, my last sort of work life years.
Did you have any football connection up to this point?
Not at all. And no connection at all. And I had never been to that city or to that town before. I just sort of calculated the weighed different scenarios and different sort of, can I work there? So at different properties of my future home, I sort of weighed in different factors, like how expensive is it to live? What's healthcare system, water, fiber, internet connection, closeness to infrastructure in terms of trains, of planes and so on, climate, social factors, crime and so on. And as I've lived and grown up in three different continents and worked all over the world, I sort of was open to move to many places. And Degerfors sort of met all the criteria. I was able to purchase a house quite cheaply. And with that in mind, I could sort of pay off all my loans, student loans and so on. And, I took myself out of the labor market. It was more a freedom project than anything else. So I sort of weighted the different factors. I checked, Southern Europe, South Africa, Mozambique, Brazil, US, parts of Asia, where I felt comfortable and liked the life and pace of living. But you have to weigh, where am I able to work? How much money do I need every month? And does this entrap me again into the sort of vicious circle of having a lot of costs and having to work a lot, making a lot of money maybe, but so I was trying to find a future for myself where I would have a choice of not working so much and still have a good quality of life.
In Degerfors was a match then. I mean, assume some listeners won't know these parts of Europe very well. I guess there's other ones, right, that fit the bill in similar ways, no?
So, and I would recommend everybody to have a look at some of these European, I think it's the same in maybe many Western European countries, where you can find old industrial towns that have sort of been deserted, where young people live and so on. You can buy quite good properties for a very good price and still have access to all the infrastructure that you need and security. So for me, it was a sort of a way of not having work or anything else decide where I should live, but take a more conscious decision where I could sort of pay off all my debt, because growing up in the Western Hemisphere is more or less collecting debt and piling it up and then trying to work as much as you to pay off that debt. So I was trying to get out of that sort of rat race and hamster wheel, and Degerfors was the perfect place. So I had no idea about the football.
You're a sociologist. What was your job up until then?
Ooh, it's difficult to explain. I was working
short,
quite centrally. The short version is that the Swedish municipalities and regions have a common organization which sort of runs all the development of those regions. So I was helping all the Swedish regions work with regional development. So I was a researcher slash consultant slash capacity building officer hired by the regions and some state agencies to help Swedish and European regions with their regional development plans, you know, innovation policy, industrial policy, everything that falls under regional development and cohesion in within the European Union. It's quite a big field.
So when it comes down to the hard facts, your sensors were already up with regard to regions, supposed backwaters in Europe.
But it all comes down to your personal taste as well. You have to be honest with yourself when you do something like that. I mean, do I need the ocean view? For me, it doesn't do anything, so I don't have to pay to have the sea. And of course, that makes my life choices quite cheaper than if you would love the sea and want the sea view, then your calculations would be different. So you need to be honest with yourself. Do I need an opera? Do I need a theater? Do I need a bustling nightlife? Whatever. Then you can choose differently. But if you're only choosing that because other people value it, then you're wasting your life. So I was trying to be honest with myself. And for me, old mill town, industrial town like Degerfors with good communications and fantastic quality of life is enough. But I had no idea about the football. I had heard it as a young person. Of course, I remembered it, but I didn't sort of connect that it's still alive and well in right. Degerfors.
Yeah.
So well, it had nothing to do with football.
Maybe say briefly, you now work at a university, is that correct? And then we'll get to football.
I have worked in the university world as a lecturer and senior lecturer and head of faculty over the years in different universities. Being a PhD, I can sort of always get a job within the university world. Currently, I'm the head of faculty, business faculty at a university in southern Sweden. Yes.
Yeah. It took me about 3.5 hours, 3 buses, 1 train to get to Degerfors. And when I got off on the central town square, at least to me, it was immediately visible. Football plays a big role in the town's identity, from the flags on the balconies and murals. How did you come across the role that the game plays for the community now? And how did you get sucked into the club all the way to becoming a president if you came with no previous football attachment?
I moved to a house which is located only like 200 yards from the arena. Let's say arena.
From Stora Valle, which is a wonderful, wonderful, beautiful old ground. And we'll get to its challenges here in a little bit. But
yeah. It's as close as can be to the heart of football in Sweden. It's a very old, nice place. And during the summer, when I had bought my house and I was sitting on my veranda, sipping on a beer a Saturday afternoon, I heard a lot of noise and commotion. And this was, of course, puzzling to me because I had moved to a small town of 9,000 inhabitants, so maybe 8,000 in the town itself. So I didn't understand what all the commotion and traffic was about. So I heard drums and I don't know, chants. I was a bit worried about what beer I was drinking and if I sort of was hearing stuff. I looked out and I took my beer and started walking down the street, and I saw that Hammarby, one of the biggest teams in Sweden with the biggest sort of following, notorious for their good fans and drums and samba-influenced chants at stadium, they were visiting Degerfors, and I couldn't understand what Hammarby was doing there. So I went down to the stadium and I saw there was a game on. So I bought a ticket and I watched Degerfors lose against Hammarby. And I was very perplexed that, I mean, this big team that I've always remembered as a child was in this small town and playing football. And then somebody explained to me that, yes, they're in the same league. This was the second league at that time, Super Ettan. And from there, I just thought it was fantastic that this small place where nothing happens suddenly has the capacity to host thousands of football fans and play an amazing game against one of the biggest teams in Sweden. So the following Monday, I went down to the stadium and knocked at the offices there and said, "Look, I just moved here and I'm a researcher in organization and steering and business management and so on, and I'm just curious how you can organize such a big event with so small means." And they gave me a cup of coffee, and then we started talking about the football and the club, and then I said, well, I can, if there's anything I can do, I can sort of help out. And from there on, I did sponsor them a bit. I had a consultancy, so I had some money, so I could sponsor a bit, and also I could help out at games, you know, selling tickets in the entrance or hot dog stand, or you know, just being a volunteer, because I thought it was fun. I have to learn more about the apparent self-organization of this very complex task. An event, which is, a nationwide event and televised.
So when you say but it's kind of magically organizes itself, you obviously found yes. out it wasn't magical. It's actual people who...
No, it was magical.
It was magical.
It's. I still don't understand it. So there must be some sort of magic involved.
There are some interesting and wonderful people involved, though. Who are the kinds of persons that make the club tick and run on a daily, weekly basis without naming names? But what goes on in a Swedish first tier club in a small town that has to host all the big teams to make not just the game day, but to make things run the way that you experienced them when you first showed up?
As far as I can say in terms of a researcher, I found quite a lot of things were self-organized. So, I mean, there wasn't one individual or two who had a grand plan and planned everything, but hundreds of people would come and do their part, which they had done for maybe 20, 30 years. And it all came together like a beautiful symphony somehow. In fact, I know for a fact, because about 2 or 3 years into my first round of when I just was a member of the board, some person quit. I don't remember their job, but they came into the office and said, "Oh, after 25 years, I have to quit this certain," I don't know what, they were doing something. And nobody in the in-house knew that this person existed. So it's sort of a testimony that it's only when they quit doing it that we notice somehow that. I often try to make a list of all the things that had to be done and who was responsible for them, just to see if I had captured all the nuances of this event. But it was almost impossible. And every week for every game, I found some new function that was just performed by somebody who had done it for a few years, and nobody was really in charge of it or had organized it. It just they saw it as their duty. They came every game, they did their part, and I don't know, like an ant farm in a positive sense. It was so beautiful, and it really grew my love for this club, and I think what holds it together is a very strong sense of culture and community. So, I just found it fascinating, and I had to stay in the club to sort of learn from this. And I tried to use it academically also in some papers, but it never panned out because I couldn't find the appropriate theory or way of sort of dressing this up in an academic language.
Huh. Maybe it's whole new theoretical innovation.
I'm sure there are. I mean, spontaneous and self-organizing. I mean, you run into these guys that deal with these quite complex systems, mm-hmm. and some of them border towards ecosystems and so on.
Yeah.
So after a while, I just lost interest in trying to describe it, and I loved being part of it. And there's a special feeling of sort of being part of such a nice and bottom up and self organized thing that really and has a purpose. It has a direction and purpose. So I stayed on and tried to help out. And after a few years, they sort of asked when the old chairman, actually not president, chairman retired. They asked if I was willing and to take on that challenge, and I was very, very proud and of course happy that they asked me, and I'm on my fourth year now as a chairperson, but they call me the president. I don't know why.
Yeah. What a way to find a home in the world.
What is Club 100?
Club 100 started in early 83 because Degerfors EF needed some money quick. And I heard it was because the bad economy, and I also heard it was because they wanted to buy a certain player. Mm-hmm. So the bosses in the Degerfors, they come up with a plan to start a club and to be a member in the club. It was for ex-coaches and players and so on. That was to have a fee for start to participate in the club. It was like 3,500 kroner or something. Yeah. And they figured out if 100 people could join, it was enough. Yeah, that was Club 100.
And it still exists?
Still exists. And we still, all the volunteer work and all the money that goes to Degerfors EF. We still have our place here.
And you have your own building, basically.
Yeah, we built it for more than 20 years ago. In the beginning, it was the small one next to it. The small one there.
A little shed.
That was the start of it. So before the game, the coaches always come and speak about the game of today and what they think that it will develop and how we should counter the opponent team and so on. So that's quite fun.
Mm-hmm. So you get some tactical insights.
Yeah.
As well there. Oh, okay.
We also make a trip abroad maybe. Last year we was in Spain and watch a game. And some national games in Sweden we go to as well. Mm-hmm. So now we should really change the name because now it's like Club 200 plus because we are more members now. Uh-huh. So that's fun. So you're welcome there.
What you've addressed now are the day-to-day, we don't even need to use theoretical terms. I think when you first said magic, and I thought you were joking, you had a point. you called day-to-day magic of Degerfors EF and First League football there. But you haven't even talked about the actual football business yet. Right? You just sold a goalkeeper to the Chicago Fire. There's a number of famous Swedish players that come out of the club. You have to engage the international transfer market. It's not merely a wonderful island of volunteers with a common purpose.
No.
It's also a first-tier club that plays football. So what about that side and that hardcore, cynical business side of it all?
Yes, that's fantastic also to learn. And we were thrown into it. We won the second league during the pandemic. So up until then, for 25 years, the club had functioned more as a local club and with local talent, maybe regional talent, not too many international players.
But we should say it has a long path. So it's a very storied club and it's been in the first league before. I mean, it's been there forever.
Yes,
but it has been in and out of the
But mm-hmm. football has changed over the last 30 years, also since they were in the first tier last time. So I mean, we're in a changing system. Global system of football. Of course, the commercial part of it has grown immensely. Since I took over, we have gone from about $1 million in turnover to about $7-8 million. So we have been forced to professionalize certain areas of the event. Due to pressure from the system, we have to adjust to the TV rights. I mean, sometimes the commentator sits in Stockholm, the producer in London, and the ownership is in America. So, I mean, even on, and TV is sort of running the show in terms of money also. I mean, that's the main income. So, I mean,
How much would you say if the club's income is TV? Like a third. Okay. And that would be normal for leagues like Sweden, Austria, even Belgium still, I think about a third.
I think so. Of course, we haven't joined the transfer money area yet in terms of club size. So we're not making most of our money from player transfers. We're still depending quite a lot on the TV and from our members and from the view spectators.
Right, TV, so, I mean,
I guess bigger clubs don't have to rely on the TV money as much because they trade players and have mm-hmm. that in their books, sort of. But yes, it was an adjustment from this sort of or what you would call a mom and pop shop, family run business, or just a close-knit community. Mm-hmm. To the first tier, where now an ever more globalized, ever more commercialized football. And we have to adjust to that. And my first year as the chairman, I dealt with CAS, I dealt with UEFA, I dealt with somebody sued us. And I mean, international courts, agents that are based in Dubai and with bank accounts in Luxembourg and more or less trafficking players. I mean, you find all sorts of things which are the backside of globalization you have to deal with. And we, of course, the board and I are not full-time. I mean, we don't have any salary or anything from the club, so we all have jobs on the side. And we very quickly had to sort of learn how to navigate in a very cynical and, I mean, global industry, which is, I mean, every part of the word industry. It's very far from the self-organizing, culture-driven community and sense of cohesion club that we are running. But we are trying to navigate those waters as good as we can. And we haven't changed our membership model, or I'm still elected every year, or not elected, re-elected. So it's still run by members. We have a voluntary board and we have a voluntary chairman of the board. And then we have now a club manager, a sports manager, a marketing manager, and a communications manager, and a financial officer. They sound like managers, but they don't manage anybody. That's the whole crew. It's like six people, but we all gave them titles as managers so that we can, when we represent and talk to other clubs, it makes more sense. But we, in doing so, we are trying to find the right mix of the voluntary and the sort of grassroots work that everybody wants to put in and keep the tradition alive, but delivering on a professional level to suit the system, sort of the national system, the international system, and all the requirements from TV rights holders and so on. So it's a balance.
How do these people on a daily basis balance, for example, your sports manager when they make transfers? How do you take into account that this is Degerfors? This is not one of the big city clubs. How do you project? How does that navigation look like?
The first practical problem is, of course, to find players and buy players or offer players a position in our club where we think the player can sort of live and work in our environment. I mean, play well with others. So I mean, what happens is that you cannot only go on football data when you scout for players. You have to also think, will they be able to function in our environment? Because it's maybe not what they're used to in a professional world. It's not bad, but I think it has certain qualities that are more like a community than a business. And of course, we would like to have players that function in such an environment and realize that they're coming to a community, and that will make them thrive, and we will sort of make everything possible to make their careers great and make them deliver great football on the pitch, but also have a great life. But it will be a different thing than just a commercial partnership. So I think for the sports director, there is a balance to be found there to sort of balance the more technical and requirements on a football player, also trying to envisage if this player can function in our environment, because that's very important to us, to keep some sense of tradition and culture in our club.
What would you say that's part of being a club in a first league in a mid-sized European league? What threatens culture and tradition the most right now?
Nothing. If you don't do anything, if you don't preserve your culture and traditions, you will sort of merge with the system and be one of them. So, I mean, the system itself always pulls us into a more professionalized world of football. So we always have to be aware of what can we sort of give up and what can we gain by remaining as we are. So it takes vigilance, and it takes also a strong sense of mission and vision to not just fully comply with the quite cynical and more and more commercialized world of football. So, I mean, you find this, it's not only words in a document. As you pointed out with the sports director, the same goes for the club director. He will every day have to face the problems that arise, the tensions that arise between a professional part of the organization and the voluntary part of the organization. So the more traditional cultural part of the organization and the professional requirements that are put in place by the system. So he has to balance this every day. And it doesn't get easier, let me tell you. Once money comes into the picture, I mean, to be frank, he has to keep 100 volunteers working at a game event when they know that some of the players make six-digit salaries. So in the old days, when I started, when our players were hardly professional, they were semi-professional, it was quite easy to get people to volunteer, because, I mean, it's for the community, it's for the city, it's for the football. But then when you infuse money into it and you professionalize certain areas, then, of course, there's an imbalance between the more volunteer work and the more professional work. And this balance has to be found every day. And it's quite challenging, but it's also very fruitful and fun.
We store some things. We store a lot of things that we don't display. And then we change sometimes. But also most people, they give us stuff, they have seen it here and they know how it both fits and not fits.
Mm-hmm. The man you met before, he's father of Ola Toivonen.
We did meet Ola Toivonen's dad right before this, correct? And these are Ola's shirts.
Yes.
Yeah, from his different teams.
And that's Melbourne in Australia.
And then he went back to Malmö, but he didn't have that.
In your collection, people also give you written things?
Yeah.
As in letters back and forth, contracts, some of the written history of football. Yeah, not just the stuff, but documents as well.
We have some. Need to pop it over there.
We're walking through a tour that says only personnel is allowed in here. Peeking in.
You have on the left side here. Yeah, a lot of documents. And also
full of old books and scripts.
Books.
This looks like a proper history archive, just not very organized yet.
I know everything about this. Here is... You can have one.
Thank you.
It's... Everything is marked.
Yeah.
So I have about 5,000 different things.
Digafush, we haven't raised this yet, but the city itself has some experience in balancing the pressures of global capitalism and of local identity. It's an old industrial town. You said that already. Steelworks.
It's a mill town. What do you call a mill town? It's a steel. It's actually a steel work or iron work from the beginning. Nowadays it's steel work with a settlement around it. So actually, I mean, the industry came first. It's not a very old settlement, and then it grew from farming into industry. It's actually just a railway line and industry. And then they have built houses around it for people to live, workers to live. So it's built around the steel work.
That kind of inevitably brings us to politics. The logo of Digafosh EF is the logo of the Steelworkers Union, the labor union. And I think politically overall, the whole town kind of has become a bit of an outlier in Sweden, correct?
Nowadays, yes. But I mean, many old mill towns in Sweden and elsewhere in England as well, mining towns and mill towns, are quite similar in structure, in social structure. It's structured around the unions. Therefore, their political parties has been social democratic or in labor in the UK. And you had always two things to actually keep the workers from drinking in the evening. They either played instruments in the brass band or football. So a mill town is structured around work. And around the union and around the sort of organizations created for the workers to have a organized leisure time or leisure. So we have great musicians from Degerfors and great football players. And that would be the same like in Sheffield or Liverpool and all these old industrial centers. It was sort of, it's social life circles around work and those clubs that come from work. So the Steelworkers Union would then organize also football and a marching band that you would need for, you know, all occasions, weddings, funerals, 1st of May demonstrations, whatever. So, I mean, you have very good. And in the old days, they were also combined. So every game, football game, the marching band would first, you know, march through city, play music and rally the people around to walk down to Stora Valla. And then halftime they would play, you know, marching music. So it was very sort of connected to the industry and to these two areas of free time, sort of organized free time for workers. And we have Nisse Landgren, who's still a very famous trombonist who played with ABBA and all that. And the latest music export is, of course, the guy who wrote Blinding Lights for The Weeknd, the most downloaded and played Spotify song ever.
The guy is from Degerfors. I didn't know that.
The guy who wrote that, Holter, is from Degerfors. So there's a strong musical and sports community in there. But that's true for all mill towns. And politically, of course, it was run by Social Democrats for since the beginning of free elections in Sweden, 1924 or something, and until 2010, I think, where the left party, the old Communist Party, took over, and because they promised to rebuild a part of the arena a requirement.
Yeah. I heard that story, right? This is the Vänsterpartiet. Yeah. It's a party left of the Social Democrats.
Yes.
Who won a landslide election. Is it really true that they won that landslide election in Degerfors? It's just local election.
Yes.
Based on the promise the stadium would be renovated? Was that
Yes, because the Swedish Football Association required a renovation of the stands and increasing the... I mean, they come with all these regulations all the time that really puts quite a lot of pressure on small cities. Today, actually, is the in Värnamo, also a small city with a... who for the first time are in the first division.
Yeah.
They are now, as we speak, they have the local municipal town meeting, because the Swedish Football Association requires them to rebuild their stadium for about $20 million. And now the politicians say no, because there's, you know, it's a poor small city. They don't have $20 million to rebuild the stadium just because the Swedish Football Association wants them to have more hospitality area and sitting, you know, seats in the sitting section and so on. So this struggle is felt by many cities. And 2010, that election was really, I think the left party got 45% of the votes, I think, or 50%, just because they promised to renovate and rebuild the stadium, where the old Social Democratic Party, which had been in power for 70 years, they sort of said, nah, but there's better things to do with the money. So they lost that election. And since then, it has been left party, which has ruled Degerfors with a brief intermission of 1 year, 2018, where again the Social Democrats came back, but they sort of, yeah, it has been back and forth. So now there's a coalition of the Conservative Party, the left party, and the budget is supported by the National Party, the Swedish Democrats. So it's a very, very broad coalition. So it has been a political outlier, but now it's more in a turmoil, I think. And the big division here is the football, because we need another $5 million investments to get the requirements for next year. And this is the big issue now with politics.
I was just going to say, yeah. I mean, the stadium question has come up again. That's crept up.
It has come up again.
Similar pressure difference. As Värnamo is, I would assume, in renovating the stadium. But before we get there, could you give us a little sense of why, in your view, Storavalla is so special, such a special football ground? And what's the flavor like right now?
Well, it has to do with history. And I think in 1938, they built Storavalla just before the Second World War as a sort of a new, beautiful stadium for that time. And it was financed by the steel industry. It was also organized and run by an employee committee of the steel works. So it has a very strong and good connection to the industry, and most of the workers played football. And the football team indeed was, I mean, if you, at that time you weren't professional, but if you could get a job at a steel mill, you would, you know, if you would sort of recruit players by offering them jobs in the steel mill. So players came from all over Sweden, and they actually succeeded in creating quite a good team and dominated Swedish football for a few years. In the early 50s, they brought in Ivan Van Peetis, Hungarian football coach, which introduced them to the, you know, the beautiful new Hungarian style of football, which dominated the world at that time. With, you know, in the 50s, it was a groundbreaking. It was like Holland in the 70s. So Van Peetis was one of that in that tradition, and they that made Degerfors quite dominant Degerfors at that time, they did world tours. They went to Brazil, to Uruguay, to Holland, played their national teams and so on. It was part of the top tier in the world in terms of club football. So, I mean, we played Bologna or Liverpool and all these big clubs. They would do these summer tours, and it was quite, because the steelworks were going fine. There was a lot of money in the town. It was forward thinking, modernistic, and Stora Valla was that place where all this came together. It was a newly built stadium in a small city, but with a railroad, so everybody could visit it. And, you know, in those times, it mattered. So it was a golden era. And Stora Valla was very much part of that. And anybody who is anybody in Swedish football will remember as a child going to Stora Valla to see some of the big teams, you know. So it's quite a sort of a mythical and maybe a romantic place for all football lovers. And it spawned some of the great players in Sweden. So it has a special place in most Swedish football lovers' heart, I would say. So Stora Valla is, you know, like holy ground. I don't know what in America, maybe Green Bay Packers Arena or Meadow Fields in New York or some mythical places like that would be equivalent.
I think sacred ground is a good way to put it. The rise of Degerfors coincides in many ways with kind of organized religion in Europe as well. And many of the rituals and the workers' rituals that you've described earlier are kind of
and maybe the peak of industry, like in the 60s, I would say that's before the recession and structural adjustments in the 70s and the oil crisis and all the deindustrialization of Europe. I would say the 60s is sort of the golden era of steel works and iron works in and there would be, I think, 2,500, maybe 3,000 employees in there was a foundry as well and so on. So, I mean, it's sort of the golden era of industry also in Sweden, the heavy industry. So it's sort of a historical place.
Now is Stora Valla, would you say, threatened by the requirements of modern football? I mean, you're under quite some pressure to upgrade. Some newspaper reports speculate you might even move to Örebro, which I'm sure you're going to tell me is not going to happen.
Well, yeah, I mean,
what's going on there?
Yeah, in order to meet the requirements 2010, Stora Valla was sold to the municipality. Previously, it had been owned by the club. And of course, now this is a public run sports arena with all the rules and regulations and stuff that comes with the public funds. And at the same time, the Swedish Football Association always increases the sort of requirements on the arenas in Sweden. It follows UEFA. The UEFA requirements sort of get more and more specific, and then of course the Swedish football follows, and then it comes down to us, and we have to have more toilets, more hospitality area, more service, better lights.
More seating spots things. As opposed to standing
more area. More seating spots and better security and more parking spaces and all amenities for the players. They need more space in the changing rooms and, I don't know, cold shower, hot shower, gym, rehab area, and so on and so on. The requirements are steadily growing, and we are trying to, together with the municipality, to sort of catch up all the time. We play catch up with them. But in terms of financing, the municipality is a small steel city which is declining and has a lot of, you know, one of the highest taxes in southern Sweden, but still cannot cope with the, you know, school and social services and so on. So it becomes a quite a political struggle always when they're trying to invest in the arena, because it's actually, I mean, dollar for dollar takes away from an extra teacher at school and so on. And we also feel very bad for the situation, because we all love Degerfors as a place and community, and we don't want to inflict harm on the municipality. And of course, we don't we wouldn't like them to finance our hospitality area for sponsors and VIP seats instead of having teachers in school. It's ludicrous. But, you know, at the local level in politics, this is what it comes down to. So now we are in just about to renovate one of the stands to more seating area. So we need about 3,000 more seats.
Would those seats go in on the long side across from the main stand where there's currently a temporary? Yes. This is also
so
where
there would be a new main stand.
Right. This is also across where the fan clubs and the ultras are right now.
Yes.
Would they move?
No, they would have still a standing section at the end of just the same as today, but the whole stands will be bigger and it's quite a big investment.
Yes.
And we'll see if the municipality, together with us, manages to find financing for that.
The hospitality is currently a tent, and outdoor terrace is wonderful. It looks wonderful. It's perfect. It's there behind the goal,
and people love it.
I'm sure. So, but you would also be required to change that eventually.
No, we will refuse.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, I'm trying to explain to the Football Association. I mean, they have their regulations, which are based on concrete bunkers that are built in big cities. Now, our hospitality area is right next to the pitch. I mean, you can have a beer and a bite to eat a few yards away from the guy having the corner kick. So, I mean, it's an extreme, in their terms, unique selling point for us. It's that close familiarity and experience of football that you had is unique for Degerfors, and which reminds people of the 60s, 70s, 50s, I mean, the golden era of football, where there were no fences or security measures. It's a very, very close and up and close experience with football, and you can hear, smell, really experience the game going on. So it's like center court seating in basketball. It's like you can have a player almost fall over you. And we want to keep that, and we will fight to keep that, because none of our sponsors or VIP guests or wants us to take that away. So fulfilling regulations that come from Switzerland and then through Stockholm, which are guidelines that are made for big stadiums in big cities made out of concrete, which have totally killed the life of our beautiful sport. We will refuse to abide for that. And there I think we can win, because not one guest wants us to change. So we will argue it from a marketing point of view, and that's why we can, commercial point of view, and using their own language, we can beat them. I'm sure.
Yeah, I think you do stand a chance to do that. And I have to add that it's not just the hospitality area at Storavalla that breeds the kind of atmosphere that you just described. Even on the main stand, on the other side, the little places that sell the sausages during the game, you're remarkably close to the pitch. You don't feel constantly policed, constantly stewarded, constantly shepherded around as you would in other settings. Even in Sweden, a few days after I was in Degerfors and saw the game against Hammarby, I went to the Stockholm derby, Djurgården AIK, the one that was interrupted for 45 minutes.
Interrupted, yes.
It's a very different experience. And it was interesting in its own way, but it's a very different experience of watching football. And if asked, I would certainly drive out with two buses and one train to Degerfors again rather than witness that.
But there is a direct train usually when they're not working on the train line.
Okay. I was unlucky because I had to switch around.
You were rerouted
in Swedish towns that I would never have seen otherwise, but it was well worth it. Yeah.
But did you notice something with Hammarby? We had AIK, Djurgården and Hammarby after each other as home games. So we built up a barbecue area outside of Storavalla. Did you see that?
Yes, in the woods. In the woods with music and...
With live music, barbecue, mm-hmm. beer, mixed with both fan clubs.
That's what I was told. Yeah.
Yes. Without any incident, not even one.
Did you do the same with Djurgården and Oiko?
Yes. Okay. And Oiko. Mm-hmm. So those who fought in Stockholm, those two clubs, previous game they had been with us, had eaten grilled, I would say meat, but let's say food. Vegetarian is also okay. Drank beer. You can also have a soda. Listen to music, singing together, partying together before the game. Mixed zone.
I have heard
this is unique in is unique in Europe. No police present. Just two security guards checking the age, because we have the same age restrictions as America. So just because of the beer. I think this is unique, and we wrote an open letter to the Swedish Football Association after this, because what happened after the derby in Stockholm is, of course, there was some fights, and now they're talking about even more restrictions, more rebuilding of the stadium, more requirements, more regulations. And we have proved that it can work with a different approach. So now we are afraid that because the concrete bunkers promote violence in Stockholm, then the regulations will be changed for everybody.
I have heard, for reasons such as the ones you outline now, from fans of all the Stockholm teams in some way, shape, or form, Degerfors is kind of everybody's second favorite team. And everybody's vision of, okay, this is how football could work. As well,
and could work. Yes, it's a reminder of how it did work, and that it's possible to make it work still today, taking the right precautions. And indeed, we beat OIK and Djurgården, so it was not only that they have a positive sense because they came and beat us. Mm-hmm. We beat both of those teams, and still there was no violence, nothing. So it's not only because of winning or losing. It's like the approach of hospitality and how you sort of welcome them into the city.
Mm-hmm. And I've walked a walk through the forest with Hammarby fans back. And I have to say, no, it's not. This is certainly the opposite of heavily policed and fenced in. That walkway there. And it worked. It worked just fine.
Yeah, and I myself put myself in. I stand in the middle of that and drink beer with the opposite fan club. I put my body where my mouth is. I physically take the same. I bet on it myself. It's not only we're not posing. I mean, I am part of it, singing, dancing, whatever, making a fool out of myself, drinking beer with the fan club of the other team before the game. So except for the Hammarby game where I had to work, I am physically there and present. And I think that helps also to show that it's not only and to me, it's actually a privilege, because I don't think many other football directors or managers or chairpersons or presidents have the luxury to do that.
Often not even with their own fans, right?
No.
If you take Aiko, for example,
No, I wouldn't risk it.
Right.
Because in the old times, they merged two clubs in Degerfors. Mm-hmm. And then they make the new arena, Storavalla.
So that merger is what is now Degerfors IF.
Yes.
Were the two original clubs, were they very different?
No.
Like, is one of them the workers' team, the other one was the...
No, it yes, to... I mean, it started just in the block.
Yeah.
And then they grew from there in two different places in Degerfors.
So this has always been the team of the time.
Yeah, you have the smaller team still, a few of them, but in much lower divisions.
How old then is Storavalla?
It's 1938.
This is the first game.
1938.
Yeah. And and one team was all on the other side of the river, and one team on this side. So they made a bridge, a walking bridge, in between when they merged, because they had to.
Yeah. To get to the games.
Yeah.
You have fans all over Sweden.
Yeah.
And there's a sign in the stadium that says "Hela Sveriges."
Team, yeah.
So the team of all Sweden.
Yeah.
Why? And why Degerfors?
Because it's a small place, and it shouldn't work, but it does work. It's like the bumblebee flying. It shouldn't work, but it works.
The antidote might be, this is nice, this is romantic, this is a good reminder. At the same time, history happens. And yeah. Change happens. At what point would you just say, look, professional football in a first league in Europe with the demands of the transfer market, with the demands of TV, is just not doable here. It's just not healthy for who we want to be as a club. And maybe second league is our territory, and we won't play Hammarby anymore. But is there a point where you would say it's not
I would hope so. It's
a new kind of rat race, which you in your personal life tried to flee, right? It's a new kind of rat race for the club that at some point will have to exit.
I would like to say yes, there is such a point. Although realistically, I don't think anybody within our organization will recognize it. So I think there is a fact that there is such a point. I'm just being self-critical and thinking that I'm not sure that being in the middle of it, that we will recognize where that point is.
I see. Yeah.
So probably it will happen someday that we will be thrown out of the, and then we can rationalize it as, oh yes, but it's for the better, whatever. But I don't think we would be aware of when we pass that point that we are passing it. I would like to think that I have the ability to sort of have that self-reflective ability to say, oh no, now it's better that we step down one step and voluntarily give our place in the first league and go to the second league, because it makes more sense in terms of sustainability and it's better for the community and for the city around it. I would have liked to be that kind of person, but I very much doubt that we will be in a mode where we can take that decision consciously. It's like saying you should leave the party when it's the best time. I mean, when have you ever done that? So I think it would take another board or another chairperson to sort of recognize, yes, now it's time to scale down and to keep to sort of find our level and where it makes more sense to be both sports-wise and financially, and certainly towards the community around the Degerfors, which will not have the capacity to hold a elite team what if we play in Europe again, like 93? Today, the requirements of Europe would be, Champions League would be crazy. Reality will come and smack us in the face someday. Yeah. Yes.
My hunch, though, was just talking to people, going down one league wouldn't be a kind of a tragedy that would rip the club apart. And naively or really?
No, you're right. It will be emotionally tough, but it would actually be more normal. This is the thing about culture and tradition. It's a funny thing when people ask me why can you be there at the top with Degerfors in the top league? And the simple explanation is because they really think it's possible. So the fans and the people in the club, they think it's normal that we are achieving like this. And it's nothing but normal. So normally we would be in the second or third tier. That would be normal, sort of. Even that would be an achievement, but it would be sort of,
normal habitat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the requirements of the fan base and of all the people around this, if I tell them, we're going to Champions League, so soon, I hope. It's normal. That's for them is normal. So it's sort of a incredible sort of a illusion that we have this grandness of football that comes from the 60s and the 50s. And it has sort of remained within the people's conscious and in the culture and in the tradition, but it has no bearing in facts or in real life. So it would be more normal to be in the second or third tier. So it's not a catastrophe if we, but due to the commerce, to the globalization and the commercialization of football and all the money involved is always getting bigger. It affects us. So the difference between first and second tier, the divide is getting bigger. So if we would be relegated now, it would be much harder to come back to the top tier than it's, I mean, it was easier in 93 when it happened last time than now. And in 5 years time, it might even be impossible because the financial muscles you need to sustain a football club at that level is getting bigger and bigger. So as the money grows, stories or fairy tales like Degerfors will be ever more rare. You can see at Wrexham and what Ryan Reynolds are doing and so on. It's a fairy tale, and it will become more and more difficult as the money in the big leagues get bigger and bigger. And we are part of that system.
Right.
We can't sort of opt out. I mean, if somebody pays $1 billion for a player to go to Saudi Arabia, that affects the whole system. So it's not in competition with us, but it affects that the second tier players will cost 100 million and the third tier player will cost 10 million. And then by the time we get a player, we still have to pay $1 million, which is to us just crazy. So the whole accumulation of capital within the football system, it affects us. Even if we are not directly involved in the big transfers, at the end of the ladder, we still, I mean, get affected.
How then do you engage this rat race of the international transfer market? What do you tell players that are interested in advancing their career? And what do you tell your own youth players as well that are coming up on why they should stay in or come to Degerfors?
After the big teams, I think Degerfors is the most known team in Sweden because of the international connection and so on and so on. Svennis and all this old history. So we have an advantage in, we are a small club, we don't pay well, but the players know that from us, and indeed we have three or four national players in the national teams that play for us. Mm-hmm. So in their own they are foreign players, but so it's an excellent window to show off your skills and to build a career. So that is on the positive side. On the negative side is, of course, we don't pay as the big clubs do. We can't give them that salary. And also we can't give them the sort of extras like swimming pools and massages and whatever they get in big clubs. Yeah. So it's a bit more simple. The lifestyle is more simple, but it's an excellent, if you love football and you want to dedicate your life to football, we actually have a good opportunity to be shown in TV and to, you know, be known internationally because our games are a bit more popular and watched also overseas than other small clubs. So that's our advantage. And I hope we can play that advantage in a way that we can sustain a good team with a good mix of local products and foreign products.
Do some players just find a home and stay and make a...
Yes, a few have the... Yes, we have quite a few that have stayed longer because they sort of settled and found a girl. We also have a women's team, which is also climbing and is now in the third tier, and have taken over maybe the role of the biggest woman team in the local area. So that also attracts a lot of female players and so on. And, you know, that's also a good thing that we are now balancing the male and female football. And hopefully by 2025 and so on, we will have two top tier teams so that also the the girls team in the younger ages can increase and attract more players.
That is a remarkable contrast too to many other small teams that are often reliant on just one big sponsor to buy their way into the first league and neglect infrastructure, identity building, culture building, yada, yada, yada. It seems like you're doing this differently. While I'm thinking of sponsors, for those who are more familiar with American sports or English teams, it's noticeable that your jersey is full of sponsors, many of them very local. What does the structure look like that the club is surrounded by when it comes to people and companies that give money?
We have 100, 200 small sponsors. And of course, in terms of financing and, I don't know, business cycles, it's better to have 200, 300 sponsors than to have 10, because anything can happen in the world. And now, looking at the tragedy in Ukraine and what's happening in the world, we can also say that the defense industry, which is in the next town, the center of defense industry is there. They have order books filled 10, 15 years forward. So it's the industrial base around Degerfors is quite resilient to world market changes. So that will give us a push, I think, that we in the vicinity now will have companies that, regardless what happens in the world economy, with the NATO 2% spending of GDP and with the war in Ukraine and so on, the defense industry and all the subsidiaries will have a stable financial base for the next 10, 15 years. Will that translate to more stable sponsorship to Degerfors? I don't know, but it's still it's not so vulnerable as if we would have one rich guy who has, I don't know, real estate, and then the real estate market goes bust, and then you lose your sponsor, and the whole club goes down. Right. I mean, or like Östersund, yeah, and so on. So I think it's a blessing and a curse that we don't have any big sponsors.
Well, you went to Degerfors, the town, not the football club yet, in order to get out of the rat race.
Yes, and then
I hear you talking like this about a football club. Maybe our final question should be: Did it work? And
it works.
Still,
fine.
Sense the joy that you described when you described you walked down to your first game, Hammarby was playing, and you were just amazed at what was going on there and the cultural landscape and the organization. Do you still feel that when you walk in the stadium, when you talk to your volunteers and your staff?
Not as often, because it was the first few years in Degerfors were fantastic, and I could sort of both observe it and be part of it at the same time, and just reap the sort of the good sides of it, and not worry too much about the results on the field, on the pitch, but just being part of a movement somehow. Now, as the chairperson, now over the last years, the results have come more into focus. We need certain amount of points to stay in the top league. And so, as happy as I was when we went up to the first league, I noticed that watching the games are much more, it's sort of 90% anxiety and 10% happiness. Mm-hmm. I guess I share this with most football fans, but it's very different from just trying to figure out how this bee farm or how this very strange self-organizing structure works and being part of that, then having responsibility for people and hiring people and firing people and always having that result in mind that we need 3 points this game to survive. Oh, it's tearing me apart. So it's a very ungrateful job to have, because it means so much to so many people, and suddenly you feel that sort of, you feel their emotions also. You bear that all the time on your, and I mean, I don't have any important function in the daily workings of the club. I just need to, but I feel with them, and it's a very symbolic and strong position, and you sort of get very emotional and, it's not always, I'm not so used to deal with, you know, emotions and stuff. So it's a bit crazy. Yeah. And a learning process.
Well, I was just going to say, this too is a good learning, but maybe not the learning process that you first intended when you moved to Degerfors, but it's the one you got and maybe the one you needed there. Maybe if I'm there the next time, you will have stepped back and are just relaxing in the hospitality tent. Is that a possibility? Or are you thinking about?
No, I would probably, you know, have that machine that checks the tickets or something. I will still help out in the game, but not in a sort of capacity as a chairperson or a president. I mean, even today at games, I do help out with, you know, the signs and carry stuff, and I do work at the games, but it's not as much as I used to. So
there's the actual labor of running a club, which is never just mere investment and delegating, and then there's the emotional labor. Right, particularly in a place like Degerfors, where so much of the community and its identity hangs on that football club.
Yeah, it's one of the famous lines in Sven-Göran Eriksson's biography. Of course, the coach of Degerfors, who went on to be the England and Mexico and Nigeria. I mean, he has coached many world teams and Lazio and so on. He says, in some places, football is nothing, and in some places, it's heaven or hell. And then there is Degerfors. So it's like beyond heaven or hell. It's like it's difficult to explain. Yeah, it means a lot to many people, and it's you really get to feel that as an outsider learning this. So it's a learning process.
Thank you very much for sharing the process with us and the heaven and the hell and the wonderful little town in Sweden.
And beyond.
That's beyond those. That's beyond those. Yeah. Staying up in the first league. Thank you so much, Frederick.
No, thanks for having me, and I hope it made sense what I was talking about.
Absolutely. Absolutely did. Thank you so much for your time and for your investment into a different vision of football.
Football is has always been big in Degerfors, and everybody have relatives that play it, and they save their belongings. So that's how the most of it come. And then we have gifts from people all over Sweden that gives it to us.
And there's a lot of things from other teams here as well.
From other teams, and even you see here we have from World Championship 1958 that was in Sweden. And Pelé was his debut at the national team. Mm-hmm. Here is his shorts.
Pelé's shorts? Yeah. I did not even see those when I first walked around.
It's only for a practice, because the Brazil national team, they were staying outside Degerfors the week before the World Championship, just for practice. And that was his practice shorts from 58. So even things like that we have here. That's quite amazing.
Yeah.
So this room is like the 58 room from the World Championship in Sweden.
Yeah.
So most of the things here is from 58. But these shoes, one of the best as an adult. So it's 32 in
Hanna
Sweden.
Lundberg.
This is Hanna Lundberg.
Oh, that one.
Yeah.
So quite. It's like she's an 8-year-old or something like that.
And she's from here?
No, she's not, but we'll be giving the things. So it's not only Degerfors, it's Sweden's soccer museum.
Sweden's football museum.
Yeah. Not Degerfors.
A lot of the ways of how this podcast gets discovered, I think, is just word of mouth. So if you know somebody who is interested in the kind of global niches of the beautiful game, and perhaps in the stories and the cultures and the politics and the history a bit more than in just what happened on the last weekend and what star happens to play where, then please do spread the word. I would be very grateful for it. I'm not super good or super invested in social media marketing, but I do this because I think stories like Degerfors's deserve a telling. And if you want to help with that a little bit, I'd be very grateful. Thank you.
Degerfors!